All right, this is Bio241, and you took a test last time, I believe, right? And then you saw your tests even in lab right afterwards. And so I think you kind of know where you stand. Oh, yeah, I do remember now. A lot of people did improve their grades. A couple people pretty good, improved a lot. Couple people did not improve. So I don't know. Probably everybody might want to talk to me about how to improve their grade anyway, because some people that improve their grade probably still want to even improve their grade more even, I would guess. Okay, so what's important? Well, those exam figures, that's as long as you can memorize like graphic information. Some people just can't do that, but I would suppose if you're one of those people that can't do it, if you practice labeling those figures 10 times, you're going to get 100% on them. And that can give you a lot of breathing room on the rest of the test. And where do you get the exam figures from for practice labeling? Yeah, on the internet. You can just download them whenever you need them, right, and print them out. So you could print one out and photocopy it or just keep printing them out from the internet if you want. And you might even have a program at home where you can even label right in the computer if you want to do that. Another good trick with those exam figures is to, instead of just printing out the figure and labeling it, go ahead and draw it out from memory and then label it. That's even harder to do. And if you can do that, then even if you're under pressure during the test, you're going to make life easy for yourself on the test. And then you can use those figures during the test to help answer other questions, right? Like there was a pretty hard question on oxygen. And I think it kind of went, where does the oxygen come from in CO2? Is the oxygen in CO2, right? Because there's oxygen in CO2. There's two oxygens in CO2 that you breathe out of your body. Does that oxygen come from oxygen that you breathe in your body? And that's kind of an advanced question, but that was on that exam figure, right? Because where the oxygen that we breathe in, where does it participate in cellular respiration? What step? One of the first steps or one of the last steps? It's one of the last steps, right, at the end of the electron transport chain, so that oxygen accepts those electrons. And what's the very last molecule that's formed? It is water. So the oxygen we breathe in our body ends up in the water molecule, right? So you can use exam figures if you know how to label them to even answer some pretty hard questions. But you got to practice so you don't get nervous during the test, right? So that was false. Yeah. This is true. Can't argue with that one. Can't argue with that. Okay, so that's real important. And then, of course, the questions on the internet. You got a whole bunch of banks of questions on the internet you can practice, and you can print those out and just look those over and look those over, because physiology, for most people, you can't learn just by reading it or listening to a lecture. That might help. But you have to work with the information somehow to incorporate that knowledge into your thinking. So you have to ask yourself questions and answer questions, and it probably helps sometimes to have a study partner too, right? That somebody can help ask you questions and you can ask them questions as well. As long as you're not horsing around when you're getting together studying, okay? All right, so maybe after lecture, When I'm done lecturing tonight, I'll just stimulate a conversation in class and just invite people that improve their grade, if they want to stick around and answer questions, what did they do to improve their grade for other students, and I'll just leave the room, right? So you guys can just kind of network amongst yourselves, okay? And just see what worked for other people, because sometimes that's very helpful. And don't forget, I think I said the first day of class that some students learn more from other students than they do from instructors, so networking is important to do. All right. Okay, so last time we were talking about neurophysiology or electrophysiology, and so don't forget that every cell in your body acts like a battery. It produces a voltage. What do we call that voltage?
Potential.
Yeah, it's just a fancy name for voltage. I suspect maybe some people pick that term potential because it doesn't sound so scary compared to voltage, but it's exactly the same thing. Okay. And so you should know what ions are high on outside the cell, what ions are high on the inside, and that helps determine the RMP, which is resting membrane potential. And when a cell is really at rest, what can you tell me about RMP? Is it fluctuating? Is it changing around? Or is it steady or what? It's steady. And that's why we call that resting membrane potential, because it doesn't change. But if we stimulate a cell, then that voltage across the membrane is going to change, right? And we see it on the slide right here. We see stimulus. And if it's on the correct part of the neuron, if that voltage changes sufficiently, if it reaches threshold, then something special happens, right? Because there are voltage-gated channels on certain parts of the neuron membrane. And when the stimulus voltage reaches, oh, usually about minus 55 millivolts. So when you go from minus 70 to minus 55, what do we call that change in voltage? Is that hyperpolarization or depolarization? That's depolarization, because that voltage is going to zero. It's getting smaller, so we call that depolarization. And then once that threshold is reached, a bunch of voltage-gated sodium channels open because they're fast. At the same time, voltage-gated potassium channels are stimulated to opening, but they're slow, so they take longer to open up. So the first phase of an action potential is depolarization due to what? Due to what? The channels opening and allowing what to happen? If you're going to choose one ion, you'd choose sodium. And what's going to happen to sodium? It's going to flow inside the cell. And since it's a charged molecule, that's a current. That's an electrical current. Okay, that's sodium current. And there are two reasons why it flows into the cell. What are the two reasons? And it does so very rapidly because there's two reasons drawing it inside the cell. The concentration gradient, number one, and the? Because of the electrical gradient as well. So both of those reasons, sodium rushes into the cell. And that depolarizes the cell very rapidly. And as more parts of the membrane depolarize, that opens up more voltage-gated sodium channels, and so more sodium rushes in the cell. That's a positive feedback. So a neuron will depolarize very quickly, and then it stops abruptly. How would you explain this abrupt stop in depolarization? Okay, repolarization starts. Yeah, it's starting over here, but there's another thing, right? There is something else. Okay, there's something else. There's a structural feature of the sodium channel. There is an inactivation gate. So if I can go back and find it. Oh, right here. Okay. Well, let me show you this. So here is a voltage-gated sodium channel in a resting membrane, and this ball and chain is what we call the inactivation gate. And right now, it's not blocking the channel. But nonetheless, the channel is closed because the membrane is polarized. It's at minus 70 millivolts. But as the voltage goes to zero, or as this membrane depolarizes, that causes a conformation change. In this sodium channel, it opens up, so sodium is going to enter the cell. But when the cell membrane potential reverses, so that now it's positive on the inside of the cell and negative on the outside, right, then this inactivation gate plugs the channel. And when the inactivation gate plugs the channel, it's no longer an open sodium channel. And depolarization can no longer take place because sodium can't enter the cell. So that is due to the inactivation gate right at the peak of the action potential.
So the
inactivation is this one right here. See this little ball? It's plugging up the channel. So we call that the inactivation gate. Even though the sodium channel is still open, this inactivation gate closes it. It like puts a little stopper in the drain. Okay, sodium can't enter the cell. And that corresponds to the peak of this action potential right here. All right, so now what can dominate are the potassium channels. They're slower to open up, but nonetheless they open up, and we can see repolarization happen very rapidly as well. What are the two reasons why repolarization happens rapidly as well? But I guess a good place to start is to think what's happening with potassium right now. It rushes out of the cell. why on earth does it want to rush out of the cell, especially, for instance, in this region right here? There are two reasons. Because the potassium ions are high on the inside and low on the outside, so they want to go down their concentration gradient, number one, right? So they're going to go down their concentration gradient, just like sodium was going down its concentration gradient at the first phase of an action potential, right? But there's another reason. Look at the membrane potential right at this part. It is reversed. Now, the inside of the cell is positive, and the outside is negative. And what is potassium on the inside? It is positive. So the positive charges inside the cell are going to repel potassium, or the negative charges on the outside of the cell are going to attract potassium. So, again, there's a concentration gradient that is pushing potassium out of the cell, and the electrical gradient is forcing potassium out of the cell. So it rapidly leaves. But when a positive charge leaves the inside of the cell, what happens to the electrical charge inside the cell? It becomes more negative, right? I think that's intuitive. You should be able to see that. All right, so that then repolarizes the membrane, and still the potassium channels are still open, so some extra potassium leaves the cell, causes this area here of hyperpolarization, even more than resting membrane potential, and then finally all the potassium channels close, and the cell membrane potential goes back to RMP. And we call this an action potential because there's action taking place right here, right? Things are happening. So for an action potential, you should just automatically think in very nice, simple terms. It only has two parts to it, two phases. The first part is depolarization due to sodium going in. The second part is repolarization. That's potassium leaving the cell. And then you should have a feel for everything else. Okay. So I think we've talked about all this. All right, so after depolarization and repolarization occurs via diffusion, it's only diffusion, there's an imbalance of the sodium and potassium ions, but don't worry because we have the sodium-potassium ATP pump that reestablishes the membrane concentration gradients for these two ions. It just starts pumping away. All right, so when we look at an action potential, we said it had two phases associated with it. There are two currents. What are the two currents? Or two changes in permeability to ions. What are the two currents? That's the exact same question as asking what are the two ions involved. So the first current is a sodium current, or change in sodium permeability, and the second one is a potassium current, or change in potassium permeability across the membrane. So we could actually look at and isolate the effects of these two currents on the action potential. And we kind of talked about it, but here is a really nice graph that's justified one on top of the other so that you can look at the timing of these different events. So what are we looking at? We're looking at, on the top curve, something we've been talking about already, which is an action potential. Right? I don't see the stimulus right here, unfortunately. Okay, but usually you would have some kind of stimulus. And the blue, is that blue? Okay, that blue represents what? Depolarization. And then this orange, green, this green area right here represents, okay, repolarization, and then you just have this little residual place right here of hyperpolarization. Okay, so let's look now at the bottom curve, which is the diffusion, which is really what? The permeability of sodium and potassium versus time. This first graph was just the membrane potential versus time that we were familiar with already. And this first curve right here just shows the permeability of the sodium ions, how it goes up, right? Depolarizing the membrane, the inactivation gate closes, and then the permeability for sodium rapidly decreases. So this first very narrow hump right here is due to what? A sodium current. And that's fast, right? It's very fast and sharp. The second curve, which is very slow but broad, this is due to the potassium current, right? And if we add these two things together and look at the voltage, you get the action potential right here. So I think this slide really shows you nicely which channel is operating more quickly and for a short period of time compared to one that takes a little bit longer to be activated, but it also stays open for a little bit longer period of time. And because it stays open for a longer period of time, all right, what's happening when potassium is leaving the cell? It is, when potassium leaves the cell, it is repolarizing the membrane, or maybe even hyperpolarizing the membrane, and that's what causes this little overshoot of the resting membrane potential. And so this overshoot we call hyperpolarization of the membrane. Okay, so you should look at an action potential. All right, I want to go back and look at this stimulus right here. All right, so what kind of stimulus did we need to trigger an action potential? I think I said minus 55. That's probably a pretty good guess. And the rest, RMP is minus 70, so what's that? That's 15 millivolts. Okay, so you need 15 millivolts from RMP to cause an action potential. That will trigger an action potential. All right, so 15 millivolts is what we call a threshold stimulus when the cell is at RMP. But there is a period of time right here where a stimulus that is 15 millivolts is not a threshold stimulus. All right, so if we add 15 millivolts to RMP, that takes us to minus 55. But let's say that the membrane potential is, minus 80. Okay, so if it's minus 80 and we give a 15 millivolt stimulus, does that take us all the way to threshold? It won't, and since it won't, even though the stimulus is exactly the same, it will not cause an action potential at this point in time. It's got to hit that minus 55. Okay, so in that particular case, that would be considered what we call a sub-threshold stimulus. So a stimulus that is issued to this neuron during this period of hyperpolarization has to be greater than the one that would be threshold when the nerve cell is at RMP. So this period of time we call a relative refractory period. A refractory period is a point in time where it is impossible or very difficult to stimulate a nerve into transmitting another action potential. That's a refractory period. And this one here is a relative refractory period because it can be overcome. If the stimulus, all right, let's just say instead of being 15, let's just say it was 35 millivolts. So a 35 millivolt stimulus will what? Take it to minus 70? And then even past minus 55, and that will reach threshold and will cause an action potential. All right, so it can overcome the relative refractory period. Yeah.
So what's it called when it doesn't cause action?
Sub-threshold. Sub-threshold, beneath threshold. Okay, so that's the relative refractory period. There is another refractory period in a neuron. And in this refractory period, no matter what you do, you can never overcome you can never stimulate an action potential. And when is that? How about when this inactivation gate is closed? No matter what you do, this little ball is always going to plug up the channel, and sodium is not going to come through the channel. And if sodium can't come through the channel, what about depolarization? Will never take place, right? Will never take place. So when does that happen? That happens right at the peak of the action potential. So from the peak of the action potential down to RMP, this part of the action potential is what we call the absolute refractory period. No matter what you do, it will never carry another action potential, no matter what. Okay. So that's pretty important to see. All right, so here's a pretty good picture of the absolute refractory period and the relative refractory period. And then the relative refractory period goes away when the membrane potential reaches the resting membrane potential after an action potential. So during this period of time, you need a greater than normal stimulus to cause an action potential. All right, so let's take a look at this slide right here. We have a plot of membrane potential versus time on this top graph right here. And this is a relatively long time, so each one of these represents an action potential, which is what? It's broad. It has two phases to it, but if we shrink the scale down, then it just kind of looks like a blip on this line right here. The bottom curve signifies when we turn a stimulus on and off on this particular neuron. So we're going to hook up some electrodes and inject something positive into the cell to get it to depolarize. We can inject a positive current inside the cell. So how many stimuluses are we going to give this one neuron? I see three. Here's the first one when we turn it on and off, the second one when we turn it on and off, and the third one when we turn it on and off. And the stimulus intensity is constant, right, for the first one, and it's then raised but held constant for the second one, and it's increased and then held constant again for the third one. So we're increasing stimulus intensity. But during a particular stimulus, we're not changing the intensity. We're just holding it constant. So the first time we turn on the stimulus, we turn it on and off, and we look at the cell, and do we see any action potentials right here? No. So what could you tell me about this stimulus? Yeah, it's not at threshold. What do we call a stimulus that's not at? It is sub-threshold, right? So the cell is no longer at RMP, resting membrane potential. It maybe is depolarized a little bit, but not enough to trigger those voltage-gated sodium channels. So an action potential won't start. You don't see it. All right, the next stimulus right here is a higher intensity. Does it stimulate an action potential? Yeah. Sure, I see a couple of them right here. So this is what we would call then a threshold stimulus. All right, now, what can you tell me about the height of each one of these action potentials right here? Is it the same or are they different? They're the same. What about the width of these action potentials? They are the same, even though it's kind of hard to tell because they're so narrow. But every action potential that's carried by a neuron is exactly the same. All right? So nothing changes. But can you appreciate, in your own mind anyway, a change in stimulus intensity? Like, can you tell I'm talking more softly right now? As opposed to how I normally talk? So your brain can appreciate changes of intensity. So how does your brain appreciate changes in stimulus intensity if an action potential doesn't change? If the height is always the same and the width is always the same, how does your brain understand that there's a change in intensity? And just to show you that, let's look at this third stimulus over here. The third stimulus is higher than the second. And look at these action potentials. They're what? Exactly the same height and the same width, but you probably see a little change. Okay? So what do you notice between the second and the third stimulus? It is the number of action potentials in a certain period of time that changes. We call that frequency coding. That's not on this slide, but you should probably jot that down. All right? The way that we explain how our brain appreciates a change of intensity is by frequency encoding of action potentials. The more action potentials per unit time that reach our brain appreciates that as a stronger intensity. The fewer action potentials that reach our brain for unit time, that means it's a lower intensity. That's how our brain talks to itself and to other neurons. This is the language of neurons right here. So what's the language of a neuron? It is an action potential. And if we were to listen to an action potential, what would it sound like? Well, it's just a really short event. It would sound like a blip. So all neurons are just talking to each other in blips. All right, so if there is a very low intensity signal, stimulus, and that could be a stimulus from a temperature receptor, could be a stimulus from a photoreceptor, or a stimulus from an auditory receptor, doesn't matter the receptor, they all send signals as action potentials to the brain, and if it's a low intensity stimulus, the brain is going to perceive a blip, 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 blip. But if it's a high intensity stimulus, what is your brain going to hear or appreciate? Yeah, it's going to hear blip, 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 blip. So your brain is talking to itself and communicating all over the body with these different frequencies of blips. And it's really amazing that we can formulate a reality based on all these little blips happening in our brain. But that's what our brain does. And so what do we call this? When a nerve changes the frequency of action potentials, when the stimulus changes, that is what we call frequency coding. Okay? So nerves don't change the amplitude or duration of an action potential when the stimulus changes, only the repetition rate of them. Okay. Now, how is that possible? You might take home a little picture as to why that happens. And this happens because of the relative refractory period. So let's look at this next slide right here. So what can you tell me about the stimulus intensity of this second stimulus from when we turn it on to when we turn it off? Does it change? It's a constant amplitude. And let's just say that it is a 15 millivolt stimulus. Okay, let's just say it's a 15 millivolt stimulus, and let's look at the next graph. All right, so it fires the first action potential. It's in an absolute refractory period during this part of the action potential during depolarization and repolarization. So another action potential can't be stimulated. And then it immediately goes into an area of hyperpolarization. But what can you tell me about this area right here? Can a 15 millivolt stimulus still reach threshold? It can't because of that area of hyperpolarization. All right, so this looks like an 80. We would have to add another 10 millivolts to it to get to minus 55. But what are we doing with that stimulus? It is constant. So because of this relative refractory period, the only time that an action potential can be stimulated is when? Way out over here sometime. So there's a big space and time between action potentials when it's just purely a threshold stimulus. Right? But now let's go to the third case. Now we have a stronger stimulus. Right? And it, of course, it's held constant. So what do we have? We have the absolute refractory period. We can't put another action potential on top of this one. But now we get into this area where an action potential can be stimulated, but it just has to be overcome by a stronger stimulus. But stimulus number three is stronger, right? So now, right? So let's just say that it's 15 millivolts stronger, so that now even when you're over in this region right here, okay, it can overcome this area of hyperpolarization and reach threshold. And now, all right, it can fire an action potential, which is a lot sooner in time compared to that first case, which was way out over here someplace. And so the frequency of action potentials increases as the stimulus strength increases. All right, the frequency of action potentials increases as the stimulus strength increases. So how is that related? Directly related or inversely related? It is directly related. It's directly related. So the frequency of action potentials is directly related to stimulus intensity. That's a really nice way of saying that. Okay. All right, so let's just draw something on the board real quick, because I'd like to see if you guys kind of know if you can see what I'm thinking myself. All right, so what am I drawing on the board? A neuron, yeah, multipolar neuron. A little saggy, but I'll put some dendrites up over here. Okay, so here we have a multipolar neuron, and a multipolar neuron like this has two main areas. And I don't think I have drawn this on the board, but if I've already done it, three. It's got three main areas, yeah. Okay. Three main structural areas, and these three main structural areas are what? Dendrites, the stoma, and the axon. Okay, so it's got three main structural areas, but two main functional areas. Okay, so where are the functional areas? Here is the first one, all the way over to here, and here is the second one, all the way out to here. The dendrites and cell body together are what we call the receiving end, or the receiving part of a neuron. And the axon is what we call the sending part of a neuron. And action potential, how does a neuron always transmit information? Is it a one-way street, or can it go back and forth, or how? It's one way. So it always goes from dendrites to cell body down an axon. That's how information is passed. And we're going to see why that is. Okay, so this is the sending part of a neuron, because in this part of the neuron, there are certain proteins in the membrane that look like this. And these right here are voltage-gated channels. And you know two kinds right now. What are two kinds that you're familiar with? Like the sodium and the potassium-gated channels. You do not have any sodium or potassium-gated channels on dendrites or cell bodies. You have something else. Not quite. Close. Good guess. I'll talk about Schwann cells in a little bit. Okay. There are other kinds of channels. Okay. So the receiving part receives what? Stimulus. So there has to be receptors that can receive a stimulus. And that's not a voltage-gated channel. So it's a different kind of channel. So I'll put it in maybe a little bit different color. They're going to be all over the place. They can even be on the cell body someplace. These guys right here are what we call ligand-gated channels. So what's a ligand? A ligand is a molecule that can bind to another bigger molecule. So for instance, you were familiar with enzymes, because how do enzymes work? What do they have to do? They've got to attach to the substrate somehow. They've got to bind to something, right? So the substrates you could think of as being a ligand to an enzyme. So for instance, let's just say that here is a nice ligand, and here is the receptor for this ligand. What does that receptor have to look like? So here is that cell membrane. Okay, so it's gonna maybe open up to be a channel, right? So it's got to have a spot in it where this ligand can bind to it, right? And when it binds, guess what happens to this membrane protein? So now we have the ligand in here like that, right? So it's bound to it, and now the channel opens up. So this is what we call a ligand-gated channel. And when this one opens up, guess what likes to happen? A lot of sodium likes to enter the cell. And what happens to the cell membrane as sodium enters the cell? It gets more positive. And what did we call something becoming more positive? This is not an action potential. The cell just becomes more positive. That is what? What do we call this little blip right here? That's the stimulus. So that's how a nerve is stimulated. When a ligand binds to a ligand-gated channel, the channel opens up, sodium will enter the cell because of the concentration gradient, because of the electrical gradient. And when sodium enters, that's a sodium current, it slowly depolarizes the cell. And it may or may not be a threshold stimulus, but if it is, then an action potential is going to be stimulated. Okay. So where do we have ligand-gated channels? Everywhere. On the cell body and dendrites. Okay, and they might be associated with, for instance, the endings from other nerve fibers that come over here. All right, so this communication between area of communication between cells is what we call a synapse. So this would be the presynaptic cell, and here is the postsynaptic cell. And the presynaptic cell is going to release a ligand, which will bind to this channel and open it up. And so if this ligand is coming from another neuron, sometimes we call this ligand a neurotransmitter. And in this chapter, we're going to learn a lot of different kinds of neurotransmitters. Does anybody have on the tip of their tongue a favorite neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine? That's a nice one. Okay. All right. Acetyl choline. And you've run into acetyl groups before. How many carbons are in this part of the acetylcholine? Two. Like acetyl-CoA, there's a two-carbon unit, so there's an acetyl group that's bound to a choline, and that becomes acetylcholine. So it doesn't look like the square, but let's just say it does, and when it reaches this ligand-gated channel, that causes a stimulus on this dendrite. And this is what we call, okay, since there's now a change in the membrane potential, the membrane is no longer at resting membrane potential, right? It's changing. So, but we still don't call this an action potential. We don't call it a resting membrane potential. It is changing. All right? This part of the neuron, the receiving part, generates what we call graded potentials. Because as we cause a stimulus, let's say we open up a sodium channel way out over here on this dendrite, and it's going to what? Depolarize the membrane. So it's going to go up, and then it's going to die away. Right? And then it's going to flow over the rest of the dendrite in the cell body. And as it's flowing, look what happens to the intensity of this graded potential. What happens to it? It's going down. It's decreasing. All right? So potentials or graded potentials from ligand-gated channels die away as they move over the neuron. So the stimulus decreases the farther away it is from this axon over here. Okay, so dendrites, cell bodies, don't transmit action potentials. Why? How come dendrites and cell bodies don't generate and transmit action potentials? Because what do you need for an action potential? You need a voltage-gated channel of some kind. And what do you have over here on dendrites and cell bodies? Only ligand-gated channels. So you only can generate graded potentials over here. All right, so here we have one stimulus. And by the time it reaches this first area on a neuron that has a voltage-gated channel, it is sub-threshold. So if that happens, what about an action potential? Well, let's start. It can't start because it's sub-threshold. So this area right here, notice that all the graded potentials from all these dendrites are going to like funnel into this area right here. So structurally, what do we call this area? That's the axon hillock, right? So that's structurally what we call this, axon hillock. And the axon hillock is the first part of the neuron that has voltage-gated channels. But let's just say that there is another stimulus that's coming from this ligand-gated channel here. What do we got? I'll make it a little bit bigger. And then as it goes to the axon hillock, what's happening to it? It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, but maybe it meets up with this one here. So if we add this one together and this one together, what do we got? Something that's bigger. All right, and now what happens? This could be a threshold stimulus, right? So graded stimuli can add together or can subtract from each other to reach threshold or to take the cell farther away from threshold. So this part of the neuron right here, the axon hillock, is sometimes what we call the trigger zone. So that's the functional way of thinking about the axon hillock. It's the trigger zone because that's the first place that has voltage-gated channels. And this is the part of the neuron that is looking at voltages as they're coming in or graded potentials and is making a decision right here whether or not to send an action potential down the axon. So every cell in your nervous system, or at least this kind of neuron, is making a decision as to whether it should pass information on or not. Based on what? All kinds of information that's being presented to it from maybe 100 neurons or maybe even more neurons. So this is an integration center even at a cellular level. Okay. Well, now let's consider this axon right here. If this is a threshold voltage, what is that going to produce? It's going to produce something that looks like, right, action potential. And as this area depolarizes, and it produces a huge depolarization, what happens to this area on the membrane? It depolarizes too, and it reaches threshold, and what happens? It produces an action potential, which then causes depolarization here, which causes an action potential. What's the height of all these action potentials? They're the same. And when this area depolarizes, what about this one here? The same. So can you kind of see what's happening here? What is the height of the action potential as it moves down the axon? It's the same height. So this axon right here could be a million miles long, and the action potential at the beginning will be exactly the same at the terminus. So it could go to the moon and back, and the action potential would be the same. It would take time to do that, but the action potential would be the same. So action potentials are transmitted without what we call decrement. They're transmitted without decrement. While graded potentials, right, graded potentials are transmitted with decrement. They die away. Right, and so that definitely relates to the sending part of a neuron the receiving part of a neuron compared to the sending part. The receiving part of a neuron is the receiving part because what kind of channels does it have? Ligand-gated. Yeah, ligand-gated. The sending part of a neuron is the sending part because it has voltage-gated channels. Okay. So that's pretty important. So that's why nerves are so efficient. They don't lose, right, their signal intensity, even though you have this nerve that maybe is a meter or 2 meters long. The action potential is the same. It's the sending part of a neuron because it has voltage-gated channels. And the receiving part of a neuron is the receiving part because it has ligand-gated channels. So I don't think your book does a really bang-up job with graded potentials, so I talked about it a little bit right here. But your book calls these cable properties. So if we were to inject some positive current, right, if we were to inject some positive current into a neuron, okay, that's going to cause the inside of the cell to become positive. That would be a stimulus, right? And that stimulus, as it moves over a neuron, what happens to that stimulus? This is a graded potential. It's just going to die away because there is resistance to electrical flow within the neuron or the dendrite or cell body. I don't think I want to get into the mechanism of why graded potentials are graded potentials. You should just take that for granted, that from the site of the stimulus, they decrease with distance. Okay, so I would call this one a graded potential as opposed to an action potential, which would be the same amplitude everywhere. Okay, so on the board, I just drew a regular neuron, just like what we see right here. And the way an action potential, so we're talking about an action potential now, not a graded potential, but the way an action potential proceeds is that from membrane protein to the neighboring membrane protein to the next neighboring membrane protein or voltage-gated channel, the action potential has to flow from one molecule to another to another to another to cause these gates to open up. All right, but there's another way that action potentials can be transmitted if some neuroglia are involved. And what kind of cell is a neuroglia again? It's a support cell, and there's different kinds that have different jobs, but let's just say this is a peripheral nerve, and in this peripheral nerve right here, we're going to put a nice Schwann cell right here. And what is a Schwann cell producing? It's producing a chemical compound called myelin, and that's an electrical insulator. And that prevents sodium from entering or leaving the axon. And let's put another Schwann cell right here. Okay. And then another Schwann cell right here. All right, so these gaps between the Schwann cells are what we call nodes of Ranvier. And in these nodes of Ranvier, there are voltage-gated channels. And when this part of the membrane depolarizes, molecule by molecule by molecule, right, it can't depolarize this area within the Schwann cell because there are no voltage-gated channels underneath the Schwann cell. So what happens is, though, there's enough change in voltage because the action potential is very big, it causes a voltage change way out over here at the next node, and enough of a change, enough depolarization, to cause an action potential here, which then causes another action potential here, which causes another one in this third node. So in this case, the action potential is moving down an axon, but not molecule by molecule. How? It's by cell length over cell length over cell length. It's hopping down the axon. All right, so it's proceeding a lot faster. And so this kind of conduction, when it is a myelinated axon, we call that saltatory. Saltatory conduction. If there is no myelination, we just call that continuous. Continuous conduction is slow. Saltatory is fast. And which is better? If you're going to go buy a computer today, would you look for a slow one or would you look for a fast one? You think it might? I don't know. Okay. It might last longer. I might agree with you there. Okay. All right. But faster is better, right? If you have neurons that can transmit information faster and you're standing on a railroad track and there's a train coming, the faster your neurons can convey information to your brain and then take motor signals out of your brain to activate muscles, the better chances you have, right? So faster neurons are a lot better than slow neurons. There are some organisms that only have slow axons, okay, like worms and things like that. But mammals, more advanced nervous system, faster nervous system because of myelination right here. Okay, and even if it's a myelinated axon, the action potential at the trigger zone is still identical to the action potential at the axon terminus. Okay, it still does not change. Okay, so this just kind of shows that same, everything that I've talked about so far, that you only have voltage-gated channels at the nodes of Ranvier, and so the action potential is actually going to hop down an axon as a result of that. And we call that saltatory conduction. And saltatory conduction can proceed at speeds of maybe 300 meters per second. That's about 3 football fields long in a second. If it's a non-myelinated fiber, it might be 1 or 2 meters per second. So hundreds of times faster. So it's not just a small change in speed of an impulse. Okay. Well, let's talk about, so we're kind of done now talking about action potentials and graded potentials. So over the weekend, take a look at that stuff in your book. Try to work some of the questions on the internet. And exam figure maybe is in there. I'm not sure. So you got to look over the weekend. If something's not making sense, then you got to ask me Tuesday, because we probably have another test coming up sometime soon, right?
What are the chapters for the next
one? There's going to be 3 chapters, so probably 7, 8, 9. Okay, 7, 8, and 9. Okay, so synaptic transmission. Transmission is just a way of carrying a signal from one place to another, and it's going to carry it across a synapse. Well, I hate to really erase this really nice figure right here, but I think we're done with it, mostly done with it. We're still going to relate to it, though. Wow, what a mess. Okay, almost done erasing. Okay, so a synapse. Let's just write what a good definition of a synapse is. All right. Synapse. I guess I could ask you, I don't know if we went over, I suppose I went over this before when we started talking about the cell. What is the structural and functional unit of life. If you're going to think of life coming from a basic building block, what's the basic building block of life? Or what is the structural and functional unit of life? The cell. That's right. That's the perfect way of thinking about it. Okay? Because all life is cellular. Right? If it's not a cell, it can't be alive. So I want to know, okay, what is the structural, which means what? Anatomy. And functional, what does that mean? The physiologic properties. The structural and functional unit. So this just means that, for instance, if it's a cell, if you know something about how the cell functions, you know a lot about life, right? So if you know something about this, right, structural and functional unit of cell communication. How do cells communicate with each other? What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? And you're going to say the synapse. So if you know something about a synapse, you know a lot about how cells communicate with each other. And there are two kinds of synapses. The first one is an electrical synapse, and the second kind is a chemical synapse. And we're going to talk about the first one first, electrical. And I think I have a slide. Right? But I tell you what, let's just think for a second. How did we stimulate a cell? How did we communicate with the cell on these previous slides? How did we do that? With a stimulus, by injecting some kind of positive current or positive charge into a cell, causing it to depolarize, right? So a stimulus is going to cause depolarization in most cells. We're going to look at one weird example toward the end of the class, but typically it's going to cause depolarization, which means that the inside of the cell becomes more positive. And so we have to inject some kind of positive current into the cell. Okay? And how could we inject a positive current? How could you think of a way of injecting a positive current into a cell? Like sodium going in. Perfect example. So if we have an electrical synapse, all right, or if a cell is going to communicate with another neighboring cell electrically, okay, so for instance, if it's a sodium that's a positive charge, right, that electricity just can't hop from one cell to another because most cells have a space between them, have interstitial fluid that separates them. And so electricity can't flow from one cell to the other because that's an insulating layer right there. Unless, under certain circumstances, did you ever like walk across a rug or something with certain kind of shoes on, and then you reach out to shake somebody's hand, and what do you get? You get a little shock, which is like a lightning bolt, right? In order for this cell to electrically stimulate this one here, there'd have to be a lightning bolt between them. Well, that doesn't happen in biology. But biology has figured out a way how to stimulate neighboring cells electrically, and that is by sometimes putting in special channels that are always open. So these things right here are called gap junctions. There are not many of these in your body. Most tissues do not have gap junctions. This just says that if you stimulate this cell by increasing the sodium concentration or positivity inside the cell, what can that sodium do? Flow into the next one. And then what? It can flow into the next one, right? And then the next one. So all you have to do is stimulate one cell in an organ, and what happens to all of those cells in that organ? They become stimulated. And let's pretend that that organ is a muscle of some kind. What's going to happen to that muscle when it is stimulated? It's going to contract, okay? So let's think of skeletal muscle for an instant. Okay, so what would this be useful, for instance, for skeletal muscle? Because skeletal muscle, what's one characteristic of skeletal muscle? Think back way to anatomy. Is it voluntary control or involuntary? It's voluntary control. You have control over it. So you can contract a muscle on one side of your body, relax it, contract the same muscle on the other side of your body. You don't have to worry about it. But what if all the muscles in your body were connected by gap junctions? You contract one muscle, what would happen? Your whole body would contract. Not very good, right? You couldn't come to class. You couldn't take notes or nothing because you'd just be tonically contracting all the time. right? So electrical synapses don't work very well in many places unless you could think of an organ that you know likes to contract together in unison in a very nice coordinated way. You know an organ that would do that? For instance, your heart does that. You only have to stimulate one cell in the heart, and guess what happens to the whole heart? It is stimulated, and that causes a contraction of the heart, and it pumps blood. So remember that there are special junctions between myocardial cells. Can you picture what those are like again, and what they're called? It's a disc called an intercalated disc. One of the components of an intercalated disc is a gap junction so that these electrical currents, these sodium currents, can flow from one cell to the other. And the other interesting thing about cardiac muscle is what? It's not just linear, it is branched. So the branches go up and down in the heart. And so electricity flows through all the layers of the heart and in all places of the heart, causing contraction of the heart. Perfect place to have gap junctions, but usually not very common in your body. The most common kind of synapse, so that's an electrical synapse, is what we call a chemical synapse. And a good example of a chemical synapse would be between two nerve cells. So here's a nerve cell. We got just a couple dendrites here, cell body axon. Here's an axon terminus. Here is the cell body, maybe some dendrites of a second neuron and another axon. All right, so I'm just going to kind of erase these things right here. And then here is a space between the cells. And we don't have any gap junctions right here. So how is that electrical signal going to get across this extracellular space? It can't hop across as a lightning bolt. There are no gap junctions. All right, so this is how it happens. So information is transmitted over this first neuron as an electrical signal. And what is that electrical signal? Well, it's graded potentials over here and it's action potentials over here, but basically that's an electrical signal. And then it gets down to the axon terminus and it stops. But across this space right here, is what we call the synaptic cleft. All right, so this electrical signal causes release of chemicals. So it's high concentration over here by the first cell, low concentration by the second cell. So which way is that chemical going to diffuse? It's going to diffuse over to the second cell. All right, so it's going to find its way over here. And guess what it's going to bind to over here? I erased it. It was right about here. It's going to bind to, a ligand-gated channel, which is going to do what? Open up and cause a stimulus on the second cell. And so that's going to cause an electrical signal in this second cell. So the way information is transmitted through a chemical synapse is what? Electrical in the first neuron, chemical through the synapse, which then creates another electrical signal in the second cell. But now we don't call this the first cell and second cell. Since this is a synapse, the first cell is what we call the presynaptic neuron. And the second cell down over here, the distal cell, is the postsynaptic neuron. So chemical synapses, or the way that information is transmitted across a chemical synapse, is what? Electrical, chemical, electrical. And now you kind of have a feel for why that is, because of these ligand-gated channels over here on the dendrites and cell body of the postsynaptic membrane. And that also shows you that this information can only flow in one direction, through a synapse. It can't go backwards. So over here, we got what? Ligand-gated channels that can be stimulated. There are none on the presynaptic cell. So there are no ligand-gated channels here to cause stimulation on the presynaptic cell. Okay, and there's another reason too, which we'll look at in just a little bit. Okay, so a synapse is a functional connection between a neuron, which is the presynaptic neuron, and another cell. That's going to be the postsynaptic cell. It could be another neuron. But neurons also stimulate, what's another kind of cell that a neuron stimulates besides another neuron? Muscle. Yeah, a neuron will stimulate a muscle. And When a muscle depolarizes, that will cause a contraction of the muscle. We'll see how that happens in a little bit. Maybe not in this chapter, next couple chapters. All right, so there are chemical synapses and electrical. The most common kind is chemical. Synaptic transmission at chemical synapses is via a neurotransmitter. So these little chemicals that diffuse across the synaptic cleft are neurotransmitters, and you told me what your favorite one is so far. Acetylcholine, right, is the one particular one. There are others like serotonin, epinephrine, dopamine. We're going to look at a bunch of others. And electrical synapses are rare. Okay, rare. So here is a nice picture that shows a gap junction, which is just what? A channel for sodium ions. When this first cell becomes depolarized, that can cause depolarization in the second cell. So here we have a chemical synapse. So let's look at synaptic transmission. This is an axon terminus, which corresponds to what? On my diagram, this little thing right here. So right at the axon terminus, there is a little swelling right there, which is what we're looking at right up over here. That little swelling sometimes is called a terminal button or terminal bouton, or sometimes it's called a bouton terminale. It goes by a whole bunch of different names. Sometimes it sounds French. Sometimes it sounds Italian. Or terminal knob. Thank you. I forgot about that one. Terminal knob. The bouton terminale is the swelling at the end of the presynaptic axon. Okay. So here's the postsynaptic cell, here's the presynaptic cell, and what do you have in between? You've got the synaptic cleft, right? So these are all part of the synapse. And if you look inside the presynaptic cell, you see some interesting structures, like these vesicles right here, filled with a signaling molecule, and that signaling molecule is the neurotransmitter, right? Okay. And so let's look at synaptic transmission. So we have an electrical signal coming down an axon, which is what? What is that electrical signal flowing down an axon? It's called a nerve impulse, and which is what? What is a nerve impulse? It's something in motion. It's just an action potential that's moving down an axon. That's a nerve impulse, right? So when an action potential reaches this axon terminus right here, what can you tell me about the voltage across the cell membrane? What happens to it? What's the first phase of an action potential? Depolarization, right? So this bouton terminale depolarizes, and in the terminal button you have another kind of voltage-gated channel. Not a sodium and not a potassium. They're in here, but there's a third kind of voltage-gated channel that you don't find in the axon hillock, you don't find on the axon per se, you only find it in these terminal buttons, and it is a calcium voltage-gated channel. So when this membrane depolarizes, these calcium channels open up. And where is calcium high? In the inside or outside the cell? It's high outside, right? So calcium then will diffuse inside the cell. But that's only after an action potential comes down to the axon terminus right here. All right, so calcium now is inside the cell, and it's going to bind to a special compound called calmodulin. And cal just stands for calcium, and modulin stands for it's going to modulate something inside the cell. So it binds calcium. Only when calmodulin is bound to calcium is it active. And when calmodulin is active, it's going to convert a protein kinase from an inactive form to an active protein kinase. So what the heck is a kinase again? It's an enzyme that does something. What does it do? Remember, it pairs up with a phosphatase, kinase and phosphatase. So a kinase adds phosphate to a molecule, takes ATP, takes the last phosphate on an ATP and binds it to another molecule, maybe an enzyme, covalently binds it to an enzyme. All right, so calmodulin activates protein kinase, which now runs around inside the cell, and it's phosphorylating other proteins. And when it phosphorylates other proteins, it will activate them. Those activated proteins will transport these vesicles to the presynaptic membrane, will help in docking of the vesicle to the membrane, and when it docks, look what happens. The membranes fuse together, and the interior contents of that vesicle are, what's the word I want to use? Okay, I'm going to say released into the synaptic cleft, but that's maybe not the most scientific word. What would you say? you would say exocytosed, right, or secreted into the synaptic cleft. And of course, it all requires ATP and energy. So what would be another reason why this axon terminus is big, is swollen up? Because it has an organelle to produce a lot of ATP, namely, what kind of organelle is going to produce a lot of ATP for this? Mitochondria. So you have a bunch of synaptic vesicles, you have a bunch of mitochondria right here, so this part of the axon terminus is large to accommodate all those organelles. So now you have neurotransmitter, like for instance acetylcholine is going to diffuse from high concentration to low, and it's going to bump up against the postsynaptic membrane, and in the postsynaptic membrane, what do you got? This is the receiving end of a neuron. What does a receiving end have? It has what kind of channels? Ligand-gated channels, so it's going to bind acetylcholine, and a sodium channel is going to open up, and what happens to the resting membrane potential of this part of a dendrite or maybe the cell body? It's going to depolarize, and that's going to cause a graded potential, and that has a possibility of triggering an action potential by the time it reaches the axon hillock. So you have an electrical signal in the presynaptic neuron, which gets converted to a chemical signal in the synapse, which then gets reconverted to an electrical signal, namely a graded potential in the postsynaptic membrane. And so that's how we understand the chemical synapse or synaptic transmission. Of course, that requires a lot of ATP to move all these things around, so that's why without oxygen, your brain can only function for, before you lose consciousness, for like 2 or 3 seconds, and then you're unconscious because synaptic transmission, right, doesn't have energy to work anymore. All those trillions of neurons that you have in your brain, yeah.
So it's electrical on the top part and the chemical.
Electrical in the presynaptic cell, chemical through the synapse, and electrical in the postsynaptic cell. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical. Yeah. Okay, so ATP is the energy molecule for moving these things around. But what is the initial signaling molecule inside the cell that is going to trigger the motion of these vesicles to the presynaptic membrane right here? Okay, pretty good guess. But sodium works through the whole cell pretty much. This is something that works only in the Bouton terminale. There, as a matter of fact, you're right. It was difficult for me to ask that question, but I didn't know how to phrase it properly. But the signal that I'm looking for is a calcium. It starts outside and it enters the cell, and it is the signal for what? Docking and exocytosing of the neurotransmitter. So release of neurotransmitter is dependent on ATP for energy, as well as the calcium signal. None of that can happen without the calcium signal. So where else is it important for you to have calcium in your body? Bones. Okay. So now I want you to give me your impression. What do you think is more important, to have proper levels of calcium in your bones so that they're strong, or the proper level of calcium everywhere in the extracellular space so that you can have synaptic transmission? If you were going to choose one or the other, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a nervous system that's functioning or bones that are functioning? Yeah, it's much better to have a brain and spinal cord and nerves that can function properly compared to bones. And that's the choice your body makes as we get older, as we lose calcium. Okay? Much more your body realizes that. Okay? And we're going to see another place where calcium is real important, probably more so than to have it in bones. Your teeth are another important thing. I know a lot of old people that don't have teeth, so they can do okay without teeth. Okay. Okay, so that is the chemical synapse. I think I've talked about this already. Okay, but this just is some text that goes along with it. All right. Well, let's look at, I'm going to draw another postsynaptic membrane. So here's another postsynaptic membrane. So let's just say that this is, what, a dendrite someplace. And here's a synaptic cleft. And so here is a ligand-gated channel right here. All right, so what I had mentioned before was if this ligand binds to this active site right here, all right, and if these were sodium gated channels, when they opened up, what would go in? If these are specific for sodium, then sodium would go in. What would that cause? Sodium entering the cell is what we call what? It's the first phase of an action potential is depolarization, yeah, stimulus. But let's just change these ligand-gated channels. Let's call these potassium-gated channels. So now when a ligand binds over here and they open up, guess what's going to happen? Is sodium going to go in? No. What's going to happen? Potassium is going to go out. Now, do we call that depolarization? We would call that repolarization or hyperpolarization. So what happens to the membrane potential when potassium leaves the cell? So here we have that plot of potential, which is what? Voltage? Potential? Just versus time. Here we're at, what, minus 70? This is what, RMP? And if it's a sodium-gated channel that opens up, it's going to produce a stimulus. All right. But what happens if it's a potassium channel? What's going to happen to this curve right here? It's going to go down. Where is threshold? Up over here. All right. So if it's a sodium channel, it's going to bring it closer to threshold. But if it's a potassium channel, it's going to take it farther away from the threshold voltage. Okay, so there are two kinds of stimulations that can happen on dendrites and cell bodies. There are excitatory potentials, which are due to sodium channels that open up, and there are inhibitory stimuli, which drive the membrane farther away from threshold. And so they are called excitatory postsynaptic potentials, excitatory postsynaptic potentials, because what? This is the postsynaptic membrane. So that's actually the next slide. All right, so a depolarizing channel causes EPSPs, excitatory postsynaptic potentials. Hyperpolarizing channels cause inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. Okay, so what kind of channel is going to be inhibitory? What kind of ion is going to move through it? Potassium. If it's an excitatory potential, it's produced by sodium entering the cell. Right, so I think you have a pretty good feel for that. And so these will affect voltage-gated channels, right, by the time these graded potentials reach the axon hillock. So if you have an equal number of excitatory postsynaptic potentials and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials, the neuron is just going to remain quiet. It's going to say, forget it, everything just balances out. But if there are more excitatory postsynaptic potentials, that neuron will transmit that information down the line. And so not only is the trigger zone or the axon hillock integrating information, but even the cell will integrate information from various areas. All right, so that's what we call excitatory postsynaptic potentials versus inhibitory. So EPSPs and IPSPs are what kind of potentials? Are they action potentials or graded potentials? Okay. Are EPSPs and IPSPs graded or action potentials? Because remember, think of that neuron again. Think of that neuron. So here's a cell body. Here's that axon. Where are we talking? Over here. Right? So what is this area? This is the receiving end of a neuron. What kind of channels are in this receiving part? Ligand-gated channels. And this part here is the sending part. Here's where you have voltage-gated channels. I forgot the question I was asking you. But it had to do with, right? It had to do with this part, the receiving part. The inhibitory, right? Are they graded potentials or action potentials? Action potentials are always what? They're depolarizing and repolarizing, right? Graded potentials, right? They can be little, they can be big, they can even be hyperpolarizing, right? So IPSPs and EPSPs are on the receiving end of a neuron. They're always graded potentials. Even if it's an inhibitor, it's a graded potential. Because if we cause a hyperpolarization over here, as it travels to the axon hillock, what happens to the magnitude of that inhibitory signal? It dies away. Okay? It dies away. Only the action potential is always going to look the same, no matter what. So an action potential might produce something inhibitory in the next neuron, but never in the neuron that has been stimulated into firing an action potential. It is always stimulatory, and it will always reach the axon terminus. Won't die away. So I think, unfortunately, we got to stop here. Okay? Because the weekend is rushing upon us. So write down slide 54. That's, I think, where we're going to start next time. And now we're going to talk about different kinds of receptors. And these different kinds of receptors can produce EPSPs or IPSPs. Then we're going to see how that affects our body. Okay. So you guys want to just stay and talk about how you're studying together, you know, or what you're doing individually, to if you have interest in just networking a little bit with each other, just hang loose, or if you want to actually start a study group or something, that could be helpful. But I know, you know, we all work during the day probably and that kind of stuff. I don't know if that helps, but maybe even online, if you just have email addresses or something, that could help. Okay. All right, so I'm going to turn the computer off, and I'm going to go get a glass of water. So, Simon, how do you study for the test? Yeah, tell people.